The headlines: Israel threatens Iran with military action, saying it's ready to target the country's nuclear facilities. Palestinians say Egypt will partially open the Rafah crossing on its border with the besieged Gaza Strip on Thursday. And Western countries warn their citizens to immediately leave the surroundings of Kabul Airport over a terrorist threat as the August 31st deadline for withdrawing from Afghanistan looms. Our top story for this half hour: Israel has threatened it may have to resort to launching military action against Iran to help the United States negotiate a new nuclear deal with Tehran. The regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, has accused Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing the materials for a nuke. Israel's chief of staff had also made a similar threat. The developments come as the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal appear to have stalled. Iran has time and again rejected any renegotiation of the accord. Moreover, Iranian officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran doesn't want a war, but will make a crushing response to any aggressors. Political commentator Tim Anderson joined us earlier with his take on Iran's nuclear program and the Israeli threats to the Islamic Republic.
This is a repeated threat by the Israeli leaders. And it seems to me they're playing a very dangerous game. In terms of accountability, Iran has been part of the international protocols and Israel has not. I mean, that's the simple asymmetry. Israel has nuclear weapons and is constantly making threats. It's clearly the most dangerous destabilizing force in the region, precisely because it is an apartheid a colony which has turned into an apartheid state, and it constantly encroaches on the rights of all of its neighbors.
Palestinian officials say Egypt will reopen the Rafah border crossing with the besieged Gaza Strip on Thursday. The official said they have been notified by Egyptian authorities that the crossing will remain open in one direction for 3 days. That's to allow stranded people to return back to the Palestinian territory. Egyptian goods and aid will also be allowed into the strip. Egypt closed the crossing on Monday, citing security reasons, following recent escalation of hostilities between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza. Rafah is a lifeline for Gazans who have been under a crippling Israeli siege since 2007. But Cairo often takes unilateral decisions to close the border point under Israeli pressure. Our correspondent in Gaza, Asher Shannon, says thousands of Palestinians have been stranded at the Rafah crossing for days without any food or shelter.
What's really happening is a humanitarian disaster on the Egyptian side of the Rafah border crossing in southern Gaza, as hundreds, maybe thousands of families are stranded inside the Sinai Peninsula, around the Sinai desert, without having a proper shelter to keep them warm or to shelter them from the sun, or have, say, running water or even bathrooms to use. And they're sleeping on the floors, they're sleeping in cardboard boxes. This is what the Egyptian authorities have been doing since Monday to the hundreds or even thousands of Palestinians who came from all over the world, coming through the Rafah crossing to visit their loved ones and to tend their their businesses in Gaza, and now they're stuck in Egypt since Monday in miserable and dire condition. Now, Egypt decided to, as of today, to reopen that Rafah crossing temporarily for 3 days to allow the entry of those stranded in Egypt.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held an anti-Israeli protest along the separation fence, calling for an end to the blockade imposed by the Zionist regime on the impoverished enclave. Dura Shavit reports.
Dozens of Palestinians were injured in a protest east of the city of Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip, where Israeli army fired live bullets and tear gas on protesters who came calling for an end to the blockade imposed by Israel. The mass protest organized by Islamic and National Forces comes as a part of the popular resistance activities that demands giving Palestinians their rights and allow the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip after the latest escalation.
Palestinians came here to stress the importance of the popular resistance with all means. They also demanded their human rights and called for an end to the blockade imposed for 15 years now. Palestinians are only calling for their rights to live with dignity. Israeli regime should be aware that the resistance will support its people and it will force the Israeli regime to accept the Palestinians' demands.
Palestinian factions warned the Israeli regime in a press conference during the rally that they won't accept any delay in the reconstruction process and ending of the crippling siege imposed for 15 years that provoked Palestinians' anger, stressing that the Israeli policies won't break the Palestinian willingness.
The Israeli crimes against Palestinians have led them to come here to voice their anger. The Israeli regime must end the blockade and the Gaza Strip. Palestinians will keep to resist against the occupation regime.
Earlier, Palestinians held a similar protest where an Israeli soldier was critically injured and dozens of Palestinians were shot in clashes with the Israeli army. These protests held by Palestinians aimed to expose the Israeli crimes amid the silence of the international community.
We call for an end to this suffocating blockade that has deteriorated our lives. This protest aims to find a way out of our misery. This condition is unacceptable. International community must give Israel a punishment for its crimes here.
Tensions along the separation fence are still ongoing as Palestinian protesters here came to express their refusal of the Israeli blockade and demand allowing the reconstruction of Gaza following an 11-day escalation. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Western countries are warning their nationals in Afghanistan to immediately leave the surrounding of Kabul airport as thousands scrambling there to catch evacuation flights. The U.S. State Department has called on Americans to avoid the airport, citing unspecified security threats. Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs also urged its nationals not to travel to Kabul airport, asking those already in the area to move to a safe location until further notice. The UK issued similar warning, calling on Britons to leave Afghanistan safely by other means if they can. Desperate crowds have gathered in and around the airport as the August 31st deadline for forces and nationals of U.S. and its allies to leave Afghanistan looms. Elsewhere, an investigation by Connecting Vets reveals new, harrowing aspects of U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan. The website on Tuesday posted some footage along with multiple interviews from some pilots that operated the drones in Afghanistan's Helmand province in 2019. According to the site, one operator admitted killing two civilians and a child, while another said the drone strikes were, quote, punitive and killing for the sake of killing. Another pilot reportedly admitted that the strikes were, quote, nihilistic, adding that there is no point in such attacks. Under former President Barack Obama, the United States led an intense drone operation in Afghanistan. His successor, Donald Trump, took the program even further, removing the requirement that the commanding general for Afghanistan approve the strike and reduced it to field-grade officers. Political commentator Daniel McAdams says successive U.S. leaderships are guilty of committing mass murders in Afghanistan.
In fact, it was 20 years of wanton killing, and the couple of murders that you bring up in your report are not even the tip of the iceberg. They're not even a little chip of ice on the iceberg. We had 20 years of not only in Afghanistan, but we had the signature drone strike program in other countries in the region, where people were killed not because of what they did, but what their appearances were, what their behaviors might have been. So the reason we don't want any transparency is because the military, the military-industrial complex, and successive political leaderships are guilty of mass murder. Well, the most disgusting part of it is to see the crocodile tears among the people who supported the wanton murder of girls and women for 20 years, now crying that the girls and women are not going to be allowed to go to school. You know, the circumstances they lived in for 20 years under the terrorism of U.S. bombs will far exceed the situation that they're in right now. So it's a disgusting game. I don't think it will change soon. Maybe the U.S. financial system collapse will cause people to rethink where we spend that $1 trillion a year.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, along with his cabinet team, has paid a visit to the mausoleum of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini to renew allegiance to the founder of the Islamic Republic and his legacy. The visit took place today after Raisi's all but one cabinet nominee received a vote of confidence in Parliament. In an address, the president stressed that his government will remain committed to the guidance and thoughts of Ayatollah Khomeini. Raisi also referred to the late founder's belief in the people and called on the Iranian nation to cooperate with the government. Iran's president said his administration will do its best to solve problems, adding that it's there to serve all groups of the society. As the Saudi-led war on Yemen drags on, the warring factions inside the country continue their fighting unabated. That's amid the worsening humanitarian situation there. The UN has focused on the famine in the country and how that is affecting Yemenis, especially children. And all of these are unfolding as the international community has turned a blind eye to the plight of the Yemenis.
There seems to be no end in sight for the crisis in Yemen. The United Nations has warned that Yemen is no closer to peacefully resolving its crisis. The international body says the country is spiraling faster toward famine and other catastrophes. Martin Griffiths, who was until last month the UN's Yemen envoy, says there's perhaps one humanitarian priority, and that is to stop the famine. According to Griffiths, about 5 million people are just one step away from succumbing to famine and the diseases that go with it. 10 million more are right behind them. Griffith says famine is a symptom of the country's deeper collapse. The remarks come as a UN humanitarian appeal for nearly $4 billion is only about half funded, and the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, says the situation of Yemeni children is particularly dire.
There's no justification for it now. There's never been any justification for it since the beginning. And it's clearly just another effort to break down traditional societies in order to advance the geostrategic interests of a country allied with the United States. In this instance, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Yemen does not and never has presented a genuine threat to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore says in Yemen, one child dies every 10 minutes from preventable causes, including malnutrition and vaccine-preventable diseases. UNICEF estimates that nearly 21 million Yemenis are in need of humanitarian assistance to survive. Half of them are children, of whom 2.3 million are acutely malnourished. Nearly 400,000 children younger than 5 suffer from severe acute malnutrition and are at imminent risk of death.
The UN has already said that Yemen is facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The National Salvation Government has time and again called for the lifting of siege on the port city of Aden. It says the country needs access to food and medicines in order to save lives, especially those of children.
More than 6 years of war have pushed the Middle East's poorest country to the brink.
The nation's GDP has shrunk nearly 40% since the start of the war on Yemen in 2015, and its currency is in free fall. The fuel shortages have become critical. Ordinary people also suffer from shortage in cooking gas. They have to wait a month to have their gas cylinders refilled. Civil servants only receive their salaries sporadically. That means millions of people have no income to purchase food or other basic services. The UN is trying to broker a nationwide ceasefire, reopen Sana'a Airport, and ease restrictions on the flow of fuel and other imports through Hodeidah Port and get direct talks going again.
Well, look, the way I see this war from the beginning is that it was a concession made as a policy decision by the United States to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which has continuously seen Yemen as a sort of colonial holding of Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis simply refused to allow Yemenis to enjoy the kind of post-colonial independence that other nations have come to expect.
Yemen has been the target of a military campaign led by Saudi Arabia and backed by the US since early 2015. The war, which has unsuccessfully sought to reinstall a former Riyadh allied government in Sana'a, has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more.
The Saudis continue to feel that they're somehow entitled to lord it over, to rule over Yemen, like it's some sort of suzerainty, with the Saudis having absolute freedom to appoint whoever they see fit as president of Yemen. And they're simply not going to stop.
The campaign has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and caused the world's worst humanitarian crisis in the country. Defending their country against the Saudi-led aggression, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have, however, gone from strength to strength against the Saudi-led invaders and left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
At least 16 people have died after heavy floods and mudslides ravaged Venezuela's western state of Mérida. State officials say rescue operations are underway to find 17 people still unaccounted for. They say more than 1,200 homes were destroyed and hundreds of families were affected. The floodwater also damaged phone services and electricity access in several towns. Military personnel are assisting locals in rescue efforts, but Mérida officials have called for more assistance from the central government, saying they do not have enough resources to help the affected ones. In 2005, more than 500 people died in the same region after rains overflowed rivers and caused flooding as well as mudslides. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. health tourism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the sixth episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to the beautiful city of Yazd to introduce you the Infertility Research Center of this city. Please stay with us. The city of Yazd is one of the central cities of Iran and the capital of Yazd province, which is about 667 kilometers away from Tehran. It is the first BRIC city and the second historical city in the world after Venice, Italy, which is located in a wide, dry valley surrounded by Shirkuh and Kharanakh mountains of central Iran. Yazd, which literally means pure, is known as the house of worship, city of windmills, and the city of bicycles. The city of Yazd was registered as the first historical city of Iran in the UNESCO World Heritage List on July 9, 2017, due to its valuable historical architecture and intact traditional structure. This has attracted many tourists from all over the world to this beautiful city. There are many historical and scenic places to visit in Yazd, including the Jame Mosque of Yazd, the Zoroastrian Fire Temple, Amir Chakhmak Complex, and the Fahadan Historical Area, with its beautiful historical texture, dazzles the viewers. Yazd province, with its beautiful deserts, has become known as one of the destinations for eco-tourists and health tourists. The serene and calm desert is an ideal location for tourists who are interested in meditation and relaxation. Additionally, sand therapy in the desert is one of the best traditional methods for treating joint pain and arthritis. Thus, a visit to the deserts of Yazd can be highly beneficial to those who suffer from joint pain or arthritis. In addition to historical and natural attractions, the city of Yazd, with the benefit of the best hospitals and doctors that are unique in the West Asia region, has become one of the treatment destinations for many Iranians as well as health tourists from abroad. Infertility treatment, cardiovascular disease, and dentistry are among the areas that have received a lot of attention in Yazd. Dear listeners, in the continuation of the program, we will say more about the medical centers of Yazd and introduce you to one of these centers. Yazd province possesses more than 2,650 beds and 20 medical institutions and 159 health centers and other clinical and paraclinical facilities. In addition, the city of Yazd is home to many talented doctors and physicians, many of whom are world-renowned. Among them are Professor Abbas Aflatunian in the field of infertility, Dr. Sayed Mahmoud Sadr in the field of cardiology, and Professor Mohammad Baghir Olia in the field of rheumatic diseases. These medical experts are not just famous in Iran, but indeed they are world-renowned. One of the most important factors in Yazd's reputation in the field of treatment is the existence of fertility and infertility research centers and the treatment of gynecological diseases, which has made this city one of the medical hubs of Iran. Meanwhile, Yazd Reproductive Sciences Institute is one of the first infertility treatment centers in Iran and the West Asia region, which welcomes many couples from Iran and the world every year. Yazd Reproductive Sciences Research Institute is located in Safoy area on Timsar Falahi Street in this city. This research institute was put into operation in 1986, and the purpose of its formation was to establish superior technology in the treatment of infertility as well as the treatment of infertile couples who had to travel to European countries for treatment. The center is currently active in the field of education of capable people, implementation of research projects and treatment of infertile couples, and is composed of different departments. The institute includes four centers in its research section, including the Infertility Research and Treatment Center, the Stem Cell Biology Research Center, the Recurrent Abortion Research Center, and the Recurrent Abortion Research Center Medical Nanotechnology and Tissue Engineering Research Center. Infertility Research Center of this institute was introduced at the end of 2021 as the scientific center of the country in the field of infertility and reproduction by the Deputy Minister of Education of the Ministry of Health and Medical Education of Iran. Also in 2002, this center was acclaimed as the exemplary research center in Razi Research Festival. As mentioned earlier, this research institute works in the fields of treatment, education, and research. The medical department of the research institute consists of five different clinics, including gynecology clinic, nutrition counseling, genetic counseling, and andrology, which have been formed in different fields to solve the problem of infertility. Presence of competent experts in various specialties of this department, such as androcrinology, urology, obstetric surgery, and psychiatry, are the turning and distinguishing point of this complex from other infertility treatment centers. Also, the most up-to-date methods of infertility treatment, such as IVF, IUI, IVM, ICSI, microinjection, egg and embryo freezing, uterine and ovarian examination through laparoscopy and hysteroscopy, etc., in this center is employed. Yaz Reproductive Sciences Research Center has gained many achievements over the years, including the successful birth of the first baby by microinjection, the first baby by epididymis sperm and microinjection, as well as maturation of eggs in the environment outside the body and fertilization. The Infertility Center works in such a way that infertile couples, after being admitted, go to the clinics in this center and are examined by various specialists such as endocrinologists, urologists, and gynecologists to determine the reason for not having children. After the necessary examinations and initial tests, their treatment method is determined and the couples enter the treatment process. The international department of the center, which is in the process of obtaining an IPD certificate for its international department, also treats a large number of non-Iranian couples who travel to Iran from various Asian and European countries every year. Dear friends, for information or to receive admission, you can refer to the center's website at www.ssu.ac.ir or call 0098353-7258-410 and ask your questions to the head of this department, Dr. Nabi. To communicate via email, you can email your questions to ivf@ssu.ac.ir. Dear listeners, we have come to the end of the sixth episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until next program, goodbye and God bless. the Spotlight.
Venezuela has submitted a report to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, with evidence of the damage caused by U.S. unilateral sanctions. Lives have been lost, not to mention the economic damage. But Venezuela is not the only country targeted by the U.S. sanctions. Countries like Iran, China, Russia, and Syria are also victims of U.S. sanctions. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how these cruel, inhumane, and illegal U.S. sanctions can be countered, some considered to be crimes against humanity.
The Venezuelan vice president has announced that Caracas has handed a report to the International Criminal Court on the damage caused by U.S. sanctions against the country. Delcy Rodriguez says there are reasonable grounds to show what she called inhumane acts committed by U.S. authorities against the Venezuelan population. She said crimes of murder, persecution, and extermination are some of those acts. The U.S. has stepped up its punitive measures against Venezuela over the past several years. Authorities in other countries hit by U.S. sanctions have voiced similar complaints. Cuba's foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez Padilla, has slammed Washington's blockade on his country as a massive, flagrant, and unacceptable violation of human rights of Cubans. In June, Iran's then-foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the U.S. is after mass-starving the Iranian nation and is committing a crime against humanity. Even inside the U.S., politicians have shown their frustration with Washington's economic measures around the world. In February, a group of 23 congressional Democrats sent a letter to President Joe Biden urging him to review the country's sanctions policy. They argued that the restrictions have led to catastrophic humanitarian consequences in various parts of the world, especially during the coronavirus pandemic. They accused respective administrations of imposing sanctions as a knee-jerk reaction without a measured and considered assessment of their impacts. That was not the first time the U.S. was urged to change its sanctions policy. Human rights groups have time and again called on the White House to end its crippling measures. The UN General Assembly has even been calling on Washington since 1992 to lift the embargo on Cuba. For years, those pleas have fallen on deaf ears. The U.S. says it uses sanctions as a tool for democracy, but those actions are contrary to its claims. They also put a question mark since Washington refuses to condemn, let alone punish, its own allies for the pretexts it cites for other nations. While the U.S. wastes no time in imposing sanctions on countries like Russia, Cuba, Iran, and China, it has rarely done the same to Israel, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and many others with checkered human rights records. Critics say the U.S. economic sanctions act as a weapons of mass destruction and a means of collective and indiscriminate punishment, which affect the health of people and their quality of life, and result in devastating and inhumane consequences.
My guest joining us in this edition of The Spotlight, we have lawyer, writer, historian, and former U.S. Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order, Alfred de Zayas. Also joining us, international human rights lawyer, Edward Corrigan, who joins us from London, Ontario. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Alfred de Zayas, I'm going to start with you. This is a topic that has been talked about but needs to be highlighted again, since Venezuela is highlighting this through a report to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Evidence of the damage caused by these unilateral coercive measures that the U.S. has leveled against the Venezuelan people, and it says the U.S. has committed crimes against humanity. Do you agree with that? And do you think, if so, will the ICC act on it?
Well, sanctions kill. We all know that. And the United Nations, in particular the Commission on Human Rights and now the Human Rights Council, have repeatedly condemned unilateral coercive measures as contrary to international law and contrary to human rights. The General Assembly has adopted 29 resolutions condemning the embargo against Cuba. When I was Special Rapporteur, that was the period 2012 to 2018, I already signaled that sanctions could, under certain circumstances, amount to crimes against humanity under the definition of Article 7 of the International Criminal Court, that is, the Statute of Rome. And I incorporated that into my reports to the Human Rights Council in 2018, and I participated in a panel in the Human Rights Council in February 2020, that was a few days after the then foreign minister of Venezuela, Jorge Arriaza, had presented the initial complaint to the chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda. At the time, that was on the 13th of February, 2020. Now, Monday this week, the 23rd, Delcis Rodriguez and the new foreign minister of Venezuela presented a complimentary report, actually substantiating further, giving figures of the human damage caused by these sanctions. It's clear that if you are diabetic and you don't get your insulin in time, you die. If you suffer from HIV/AIDS, you don't get your antiretroviral drugs in time, you die. Now, it is proven that these very comprehensive unilateral coercive measures applied against Venezuela have directly caused the deaths of tens of thousands. Professor Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University in New York, mm-hmm. and Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., issued a report in 2019 estimating that alone for the year 2018, 40,000 persons had died. Now, as you know, I was the first and rapporteur of the United Nations to go to Venezuela. I had the opportunity of speaking with civil society, with NGOs, with the government and ministers, right. and I received ample information as to the impact of these sanctions, which of course has gotten much worse since I was mm-hmm. in Venezuela. I like to compare these sanctions with the medieval sieges of towns, you know, when an army wanted to starve a town to death. So right. it got encircled and no food came in. That is also not unlike the encircling of Leningrad by the Nazis, 1941 to 1944. Which caused an estimated 700,000 deaths. Uh-huh. So this is what I think the function of the United Nations to quantify the damage. UNICEF, for instance, could issue a well-based estimate of the number of children
okay.
who okay. have died as a consequence of these sanctions. As they did, by the way, in the 1990s,
sure.
concerning the sanctions against Iraq.
Sure, but let me just get in on a number that you mentioned in a report that was released back in 2019, and bring you in Edward Corrigan, in which our guest there talked about how as many as 40,000 Venezuelans may have died as a result of these U.S. sanctions, which made it harder for the ordinary Venezuelans to get access to food, medicine, and medical equipment. That was 2019, 40,000 people. So when you have a figure like that, which is quite incredible and shocking, the question that comes about, aside from the fact that what has been done about it, is the ones who are exercising the sanction, i.e. the U.S. and its officials, is their aim to produce results like that, for 40,000 people to die?
Madeleine Albright, when she was Secretary of State in the United States, in response to a question, but you know, that 500,000 Iraqis had died due to the sanctions, you know, just said that that was an acceptable number. And, you know, it was, you know, shocking in its, I guess, you know, for being true, but also for an admission of, you know, sort of that they didn't care of what the impact was on people. What we're seeing is, you know, the medieval siege sanctions issue, I think, is a very appropriate way to compare. But you're looking at the United States trying to enforce on its allies and other people a sort of collective punishment against the civilians in Venezuela, in Cuba, in Nicaragua, Yemen, attacking, you know, putting pressure on China and Russia. Any other country that pursues an independent, you know, political policy. And, you know, this is really an attack on democracy. The government in Venezuela was democratically elected, but the Americans didn't like the results, so then they're trying to punish the people and, you know, killing 40,000, you know, in 1 year. Plus, you know, whenever Bush, there was, the CIA was involved with trying to overthrow Chavez, and the American administration immediately recognized the new regime. So it shows that the support for democracy is a lie. If they don't like the democratic result, they want to change the results and the voters, and they're not really concerned about democracy. They're concerned about you know, power and what they can exploit economically. Now, the incidents when the coup took place in Venezuela, the coup collapsed. The Venezuelan Air Force said, we're going to bomb you if you don't step down. And, you know, Chavez was reinstated, and the people in Venezuela, you know, secured control of their own destiny. But it made the Americans look quite foolish, quite frankly. But now you've got the Americans hijacking, you know, oil tankers, kidnapping you know, diplomats, which they did recently for Venezuela. They're trying to, you know, use COVID vaccinations and other things as a way of punishing people that don't bow to the American, you know, way of doing things. And of course, the Americans are not interested really in the people in the countries that they're affecting, but they're interested in, you know, getting profits for the shareholders and the multinational companies that are taking advantage of. Somebody described the United States as an oil company with an army, you know, so that is an appropriate designation for oil, but it extends to other corporate areas. And in these cases, they're always extracting money and wealth from these countries for themselves, and their shareholders have little or no concern for the people in these countries themselves.
Okay, well, Alfred Isaias, one of those countries that obviously is suffering in many ways from this is the Islamic Republic of Iran. American officials have always argued, Alfred Isaias, that they don't block activities of financial transactions that relate to humanitarian aid. But we have witnessed, and this is coming firsthand, obviously, given the fact that we're doing an interview from the Islamic Republic, that this is just not the case. Plenty of reports out there, plenty of coverage that we have done that shows that these U.S. sanctions are blocking medical supplies to come into the country, medicine to, in not just for COVID-related issues, but other types of diseases. And Iran has been a victim of these U.S. sanctions in more ways than one, not to mention the economic sanctions and how that has damaged the country. Venezuela, 40,000 deaths the year 2019. You said there's probably more. And Iran, there has been a number of deaths. Why isn't Iran highlighted in that respect, do you think? And what do you think needs to be done in order for Iran's case to come into the picture in the way that it should?
Well, it is in the picture. And when I write about unilateral coercive measures, I mentioned that there are over 30 countries that are under U.S. sanctions, and that these sanctions are not smart sanctions, that these sanctions actually, because of the phenomenon of overcompliance, leads to a complete breakdown of trade. And that impacts all humanitarian aid and impacts medicines, impacts food, etc. Even if it's possible to obtain, theoretically, obtain waivers so that you can import, export into Iran or into Venezuela, it simply does not work in a capitalistic world where an entrepreneur, a businessman, has to estimate his risks. If there is a risk of being sanctioned or being penalized by the Department of the Treasury with $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. Obviously, a businessman is going to pull out, is not going to do any kind of business, be it with Syria, be it with Iran, be it with Venezuela, and that is the situation that we are living. Now, that is completely contrary to the United Nations Charter, numerous articles of the United Nations Charter. I would like to see the International Court of Justice pick up the issue for an advisory opinion that can be done in the General Assembly by obtaining majority plus one and elevating the legal issue of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures to the International Court of Justice and have the International Court of Justice determine, number one, that of course they are contrary to the United Nations Charter, and secondly, that entails state penal and civil liability, meaning that the United States owes trillions of dollars of reparations to all the countries that have unjustly suffered under illegal sanctions.
Sure.
That, of course, is just law.
Sure,
that's how you're going to enforce it. That's something entirely different.
Of course, of course. And that's great, because perhaps we need to expand a little bit with you, Edward Corrigan, when it comes to how the U.S. says humanitarian supplies, humanitarian aid is exempt. Take the case of Cuba, for example. Just recently, Biden threw its support and weight behind the protesters who had come out, and really because of COVID-19, one of the reasons they came out and protested. But what was really the problem with Cuba, with U.S. sanctions, is something that is not highlighted, and that was what former U.S. President Donald Trump did, aside from calling, Cuba a terrorist entity. He went and he cut the Western Union offices in Cuba. There were 400 of them. Money that came from the U.S. or overseas into Cuba, which is one of the primary sources of revenue, upwards of $1 billion. It cut that. It was a very severe act, not highlighted in a lot of publications. And Cuba, you know, how much money does its GDP generate? And they're suffering because of that. Can you please tell us, is the U.S. Lying when it says no, it's exempt? And why doesn't then the U.S. get accused of this or maybe in a bigger picture get prosecuted for it? Because humanitarian supplies are obviously not exempt.
Well, there's a blatant double standard. The Americans use whatever power they can. They see their own, you know, corporations as an extension of their power, and they threaten the corporations, if you don't do this, we're going to punish you in our market. And as a result, Western Union would shut down 1,000 offices in Cuba, which give money to the Cuban people from overseas in the United States and elsewhere. But, you know, it's this extension of corporate power and trying to force other countries to obey the American rules. And, you know, they have a lot of leverage, but it really is they're trying to do a third-party extension of their rules and applying them to other countries. For example, why should Iraq require, you know, waivers from the United States to import oil or gasoline from neighboring Iran? You know, why should the United States be punishing Russia and Europe for building a gas and oil pipeline from Russia into Europe, so that Europe has more diverse supplies and isn't dependent on any one source? The Americans want to have control of that, and they don't want to compete in a fair market value or a fair market system. They want to be able to impose their control and their will, and then extract resources, which invariably, you know, hurts the population. You know, Gaddafi used oil in Libya to, you know, it was one of the highest standard of living, if not the highest standard of living of all of Africa. Everything was subsidized. You know, it was free healthcare, free education, you know, great subsidies for housing, for gas.
Right.
And because, you know, Gaddafi was using the oil resources for the benefit of the people and other things that the Americans and the British and the French and the Italians and like, they overthrew him. And now the money is going out to, you know, to American and other countries,
sure,
you know, corporations, and the people are deprived of it. I'm sure they'd love to get Gaddafi back, but it's sort of a form of banditry or outright theft of the resources of,
right,
not only Libya, but other countries.
Okay, we got just a little bit of time here, so I have to address the last question to you, Alfred Desaias. Aside from the fact that statistics out there that show that these are politically and ideologically driven sanctions by the U.S. has been not very successful in terms of its stated aims. We could mention Iran, we could mention Venezuela, we could mention Cuba, we could mention Syria. One of the things that it does do is it becomes counterproductive, because you're going to take a look at some of these countries and how they're suffering, what the people actually think of the U.S. You know, if you have Mike Pompeo, the former Secretary of State, saying, you know, the people of Iran are going to have to suffer from not having food to eat if and I'm not going to use the words that he used to describe the ruling government. You know, when he says things like that, people are going to come out against the U.S. in terms of what they think of the U.S. And, of course, you know, that's something that I'm guessing is not what the U.S. aim is here. Overall, do you think that the U.S. realizes the sanctions are not really producing the results that they want?
Well, there are plenty of professors like Jeffrey Sachs, like Dan Kovalik, who realize the absurdity of the sanctions policy. It is a completely failed model. Take Cuba. It's been 60 years of sanctions, and the Cuban people have not risen to overthrow the current regime of Díaz-Canel or of the Castro brothers, etc. The fact is that, as Julius Caesar used to say, quae volumus ea credimus libenter, that which we want to believe, we do believe. And people like Pompeo, like John Bolton, like Trump, they live in their own world.
Uh-huh.
Live in their own world.
Sure.
They don't realize that we Americans, and I am an American citizen,
okay,
that we Americans are hated.
I'm so sorry. I got to jump in here because we're just out of time. I do apologize. Time just got the best of us. Alfred Desaias there. Thank you so much. Lawyer, writer, historian, former U.S. Special Rapporteur. Thank you, Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. From Mika Vitale, entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. We, first and foremost, my condolences to the Islamic community and to Sahib al-Asr wa Zaman, our master and Mawla, may Allah hasten in his reappearance, on the occasion of the months of Muharram and Safar, where we commemorate the tragedies and the injustice that the holy household of our beloved Prophet had to go through. And I hope that the ziyarah of the shrine of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam is written in all our near future decrees, and may we all be blessed with a chance to glance upon his golden dome and to breathe the air of his divine shrine. In the studio with me, I have two special guests, as always. Brother Yasir, salamun alaikum.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Brother Abdullah, salamun alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so very much for being with us. Guys, question. When was the last time you went to Karbala? This is an actual question.
Oof.
Seriously? Oof?
4 years ago. Four or five years ago.
And the pandemic has a lot to do with it, though.
We were supposed to go just before the pandemic came.
Oh, no.
So the pandemic canceled the trip. That would have been 2 years ago. 2 years ago, yes. So that was the last time was 4 or 5 years ago.
Said, when was the last time you were at Karbala?
Alhamdulillah, I had the pleasure of being there about 4 months ago.
May Allah accept your pilgrimage, and may you be blessed with more frequent chances and opportunities to visit the holy shrine of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and Abul Fadl al-Abbas. But why do you think this is? What is it about the importance of Imam al-Husayn's shrine? Because you even hear ahadith. I'm not sure how reliable these ahadith are, or maybe it's just like passionate literature expressions of some very creative poets where they talk about how Karbala is having a conversation